Win stacks of cash by entering the 150K Crack the Code giveaway, brought to you by your local paper, now through July 14th. Look for the code on page A2. Then visit 150kgiveaway.com and submit your entry. You could win the grand prize of $100,000. Grab the paper every day. Get the code on page 2A and improve your chances to win tons of weekly cash prizes. Visit 150kgiveaway.com for details.
Hey, everyone. Welcome to this special podcast on our coverage of Mount Carmel and Dr. Heusel, the former doctor who's been indicted now on causing the death of numerous patients at Mount Carmel. You're about to hear a podcast recorded with myself and my colleagues, but an editor's note first. Shortly after we recorded the podcast, Mount Carmel released some breaking news. We had asked Mount Carmel a series of questions, which they did not answer, but we told them we were getting ready to publish a story in Sunday's paper that outlined some of the issues we found with their procedures and protocols. And that news that broke on Thursday was that they had fired 23 employees and their CEO, Ed Lamb, was resigning on July 25th and their VP was retiring in September. So as you listen to this podcast, just keep in mind that at the time we were not aware of that, but wanted to make you aware of it now. Hello, everyone. Thanks for joining us. I'm here with fellow dispatch reporters Joanne Viviano and Mike Wagner. Myself, I'm Lucas Sullivan, and we're here to talk about the next installment of our Mount Carmel Dr. Heusel coverage, which Joanne began about 6 months ago, roughly, right, with the news of a doctor who had may have been using excess doses of painkillers to end the lives of patients. And the next installment, we've kind of been gathering that entire period of 6 months, trying to piece together what Mount Carmel knew, what they did, didn't do, and just to see what their role was in this kind of rogue doctor doing what he did. So I know that throughout this process, Mount Carmel has kind of sidestepped our questions about their role in it. Joanne, you've talked a lot directly with Mount Carmel. So if you could kind of talk about some of the things that you saw from Mount Carmel and what we were able to print.
Well, it looks like some of the main concerns have been whether or not they had policies in place that could have prevented nurses and doctors from accessing large amounts of medications, narcotics such as fentanyl, morphine, and those types of things. And so the concern is whether those policies were in place to prevent that from happening, but also whether anyone was reviewing what was happening. Because in some cases, we're told there were several vials of this fentanyl removed from these machines and appears to have gone unnoticed for a very long time. So that's a concern. And also, some of the questions being raised are whether they should have limited the amount of fentanyl that was even available in these machines. So these are machines that are on the floor in the ICU that are automated. And so nurses and doctors can use overrides to get medications out of them, sort of sidestepping the pharmacy. They also use these overrides to sidestep warnings that the machines would be programmed to alert them if there were some kind of concerns with the medication, such as an allergy. The patient might have an allergy or the dosage was wrong.
And Mike, on the law enforcement side, which you and I paid a lot of attention to while Joanne was talking with Mount Carmel, what were some of the things that they said about this, you know, the role and how they treated the employees, the nurses, the pharmacists who were involved in this with Dr. Heusel?
Sure. For anyone that's not been following this case, Heusel was indicted on 25 counts of murder and potentially will stand trial. It's expected to, if it goes to trial, expected to spill into next year, and it could last weeks or even months, depending on the amount of the medical testimony. But from a law enforcement standpoint, you know, one of the biggest criticisms or concerns that some family members and people in the general public have had is that all the attention has been just on Heusel. Well, what about the other folks in the hospital that work with him during that four-year period, and what is their responsibility in this? And so Franklin County Prosecutor Ron O'Brien has heard this criticism that why wasn't anyone else charged? And what O'Brien has told us, and he tells us for this story, is that during their investigation, they did not see conduct that rose to a criminal level when it came to the nurses, the pharmacists, any other doctors that might have been involved in these cases along with Heusel, or the administration or the hospital itself. You know, Ron has been very complimentary of the hospital so far throughout this, saying that they have been very forthcoming and cooperated every step of the way. But Ron has also told us that it doesn't mean that there weren't things that were wrong. They're just actions or people that could have complained or could have done something to alter the course of what Husel was doing with ordering these excessive doses of painkillers. But it didn't happen. Now, whether there'll be consequences for the nurses and pharmacists down the road with their licenses, the nursing board, the state nursing board, and the pharmacy board are both going to be eventually holding hearings to decide whether those folks should continue to be able to practice.
Joanne, roughly how many employees throughout the course of all these lawsuits and conversations we've had with Mount Carmel, how many nurses, pharmacists, administrative staff are we talking about that could be involved in this entire process?
Well, in my opinion, there's dozens. The hospital has said that there were, I believe, about 36 nurses and pharmacists that they were considered involved in this. But there also are a number of other folks that may have had an opportunity to see what was happening. Attending physicians, people who signed the death certificates, supervisors and administrators who may or may not have reviewed charts or, as I said before, taken a look at what kind of medications were being taken from these machines and by what process. So I think that there are a lot of people here that may have had an opportunity to say something or see something and perhaps did not.
And we were told by the prosecutor's office, Ron O'Brien and others, that there were some complaints made by, we're not sure the number, involving at least one nurse and at least one pharmacist, again, not sure how many, and those complaints or those challenges to Husel's orders didn't make it all the way up to the administrative level for whatever reason.
Yeah, he said that they followed their chain of command with inside the hospital, but correct me if I'm wrong, he wasn't sure where they stopped.
Correct.
At some point, though, that they didn't make it up to those levels.
So, you know, just take the nursing level for a second. So if a nurse receives an order for 1,000 micrograms of fentanyl from Husel, and she believes that that's an inappropriate dosage, Joanne and I are not 100% sure of what the policy was, but generally what we're being told is that that nurse should have registered a complaint with what's called the charge nurse, or the nurse that was sort of on duty and overseeing the other nurses in the ICU that night. And then that charge nurse would take it to the supervisor of nurses. And then if the supervisor of nurses has a problem, then she then takes it to the, we're told that there's an administrator on call 24 hours that is available to hear things like this. So whether something happened within the chain of command, we don't know. As you guys already noted, the hospital has declined to talk about their procedures and policies that were in place at the time.
Yeah, and that's been their stance with us, and especially they've released statements to us since the indictment came down on Dr. Husel that they've been instructed by Ron O'Brien not to talk about it as he prepares for trial and there's discovery among both sides of the defense and a prosecution. But you guys also found that some of the attorneys were also trying to piece this together, right?
Yes, the attorneys are in the civil lawsuits. So several families are suing or have filed lawsuits against Dr. Husel and Mount Carmel wrongful death lawsuits. And they have been asking for evidence, basically. They want Mount Carmel to turn over some of this information as far as what their policies were and several other types of documents that they might have. A magistrate in the Franklin County Common Police Court has said that that can happen, that that can go forward. He has said that Dr. Husel does not have to testify, which could violate his Fifth Amendment right to self-incrimination. And since he's under criminal investigation, his criminal charges against him, on the civil side, they've said he doesn't have to do any depositions or do any testimony. So his lawyer in Mount Carmel are asking judges to overrule the magistrate and say no, that Mount Carmel doesn't have to turn over any information. So there's sort of this back and forth going on, although the attorneys really do want to see what was the case at the time.
Mike, these frustrations on the family side of this have boiled over kind of privately, I guess, but they had a meeting with Ron O'Brien. Can you kind of talk about that a little bit? As we understand it, anybody who was associated with one of the victims was invited to show up at the Columbus Police Training Academy where they had a meeting and were able to voice questions or concerns about what was going on.
Yeah, O'Brien's office took the lead in organizing the meeting, and they wanted to give, as you pointed out, family members that are connected with the patients, the 25 patients that are listed in this indictment. They wanted to give them a chance to be heard and also make it clear, you know, where law enforcement stood, both with the investigation they just concluded and moving forward now as they're headed towards a trial. And this wasn't the first time we've heard this, but you know, several families have been very emotional. The hardest part, I think, for them is this burden of guilt now, where when they had these conversations with Dr. Husel and they're discussing situations like taking a loved one off a ventilator, and they're told that your loved one's going to die, but we're going to provide comfort care, or we're going to make sure there's no pain, or whatever that language was. And they were very accepting and trusting that, okay, this is the right decision. Well, now this has come out. So now they're all questioning whether, oh my gosh, should we have done more? You know, maybe my wife or my sister or my husband would still be alive if we had asked more questions. Yeah. So that's a really difficult thing. So at this meeting, I wish we could give details, but people are very hesitant to talk about what was shared in the meeting. We know it was emotional. We've been told that the families have differing opinions on, you know, how many cases were indicted, and they're not seeking the death penalty. It's not a capital case. I think some families wanted that in play. I think others are satisfied with what's happened, but it was a very emotional meeting. But out of respect for the families, O'Brien declined to give any details on it.
Yeah, but he has addressed publicly, you know, seeking the death penalty, and his point is that there wasn't evidence that he planned this out.
Correct.
And to show that there was this
prior intent.
Yeah, this prior intent, and so therefore he felt his office wasn't on firm ground to seek the death penalty. Again, there's still a lot here. Is there anything else that we didn't get to that you guys want to?
I think Joanne should talk about one huge element in the story for Sunday is the case of Bonnie Austin. And we were able to talk with her husband. And I think Joanne could share some insight on that.
Yeah, Bonnie had gone into the hospital. She had some trouble breathing as she was watching TV with her husband and was taken into the hospital and had died just a few hours later. Her husband is really torn. He feels like if she had not been given a high dose of fentanyl, that she may have walked out of the ICU alive like she had in previous visits there. So he's really torn up about that. And it kind of shows how these families are, like Mike said, really conflicted over whether or not they had made the right decisions and whether or not their loved ones could have survived. And the real concern is that they just will never know. They can't go backward. They'll never know. So they can't get any sort of clarification over whether or not they made a good decision or not. But I also think it's worth noting that we did talk to some folks who make recommendations as far as these automated medication dispensing cabinets go, and also a group that takes a look at hospital policies to see how adequate they are. And what I was told is that there are a lot of concerns with these machines, that they recommend that these machines be there, and more hospitals are using them. However, the concern is they're not using them effectively, and there are a lot of mistakes being made. One recent example, there was a nurse, a woman in Tennessee at Vanderbilt, and she did an override of one of these machines. She was having trouble finding Versed, which is an anti-anxiety medication for a woman who I believe was getting an MRI. And she couldn't find it. She overrid the system, typed in VE, and got a different medication, which was a paralytic, and ended up leaving this woman brain dead. So she's been charged criminally as well. So there are some issues with these machines, and my understanding is less than half of the hospitals that have them actually comply with some of the protocols that are set up by.
Are these the Pyxis machines?
Yes.
Okay. That's what they're called internally.
The brand is Pyxis. I think there's another brand out there as well. I don't think they're the only ones that make these machines, but yes, they're often referred to as Pyxis machines.
Yeah, and that has become an issue too, so much so that law enforcement, the prosecutor's office and police have said openly that they went and wanted to look at these machines themselves, because that has become a very important part of this case and how they're administered and the oversight of them and how they're used and how a doctor could or could not, or a nurse could or could not, manipulate them or sidestep some of the alerts.
Sure. And I think like some of these national organizations have those concerns about hospitals as a whole, not specifically any one hospital, but just in general, that these hospitals are not using them in the best way possible, perhaps.
And if I could back up for just one second, it's not just the family members' belief that some of their loved ones might have lived. The hospital itself has said on the record that at least 5 patients had a good chance of recovery. So I think that's important to note.
So we brought you up to date on the next installment. You can check it out online or in Sunday's Dispatch. There are some things in there, just to tease a little bit, that you will want to check out. We did ask Ron O'Brien about his thoughts on some of the procedures and protocols that Mount Carmel had in place, and he shared some thoughts. We found some entities that actually come in and inspect or write reports on best practices of hospitals and give ratings to hospitals, and we got some ratings and grades of Mount Carmel that raised some issues. And also, as Joanne touched on, some of just the raw emotion from family members that will be detailed in that story. So there are a lot of things in that story that you will want to check out if you've been following this. And if you haven't, you know, you can jump right in and catch right up with what's going on. So thanks a lot for reading, staying with us, and we'll talk to you soon.